Today's discussion, Immigrant Integration in Europe in a Time of Austerity, was held in London. The discussion begins with an introduction by Barrow Cadbury Trust Chief Executive Sarah Llewellyn, and the other discussants are Migration Policy Institute President Dimitrios Papadimitriou, Trevor Phillips, who is Chairman of the United Kingdom's Equality and Human Rights Commission, Nicholas Marugán-Zalba, Director of Spain's Observatory on Racism and Xenophobia, and Liz Collette of the Transatlantic Council on Migration and an author of the MPI report being discussed today. Here is Sarah Llewellyn.
Welcome, everybody, to today's event. This is being jointly hosted by the Barrow Cadbury Trust and the Transatlantic Council on Migration. We're very proud to be the UK partner to the Transatlantic Council and to contribute in our small way to its very important work on both sides of the Atlantic and beyond. It's also my great pleasure today to honour to announce the launch of the Council's new book called Prioritising Integration, published in partnership with the Bertelsmann Foundation in Germany. That can be found on the Transatlantic Council's website or on the Bertelsmann website, and we'll have the details up here if anyone would like to get that later. That it covers... It's a collection of essays about education, employment, the impacts of the recession in Europe and in the US, and with some thoughts about future post-recession needs. So we'll put that to one side for just now. Welcome. Do come and join us, Mr. Phillips. We're literally just starting. The Barrow Cadbury Trust, many of you are friends of the Barrow Cadbury Trust already, so I won't say too much, but... We're the 90-year-old philanthropic foundation of the Cadbury family. Barrow and his wife, Geraldine, were Quakers, and they lived fairly modestly and endowed the trust with a considerable amount of their money. And Geraldine, in particular, was a mover and shaker of her day, especially in criminal justice circles, and she was Barrow's inspiration. The trust has always worked to what we call speak truth to power, and aims to bring the voices of marginalised people into the corridors of power. Our model is to fund work at the grassroots and campaigning on the one hand, and research and public policy work in our areas of interest on the other. And then we aim to get the two into synergy, which isn't always very easy, and we certainly hope there are some campaigners and grassroots activists here today. We certainly want to hear from you as well as the theoreticians later on today. We're a social justice foundation, and our areas of interest are in criminal justice, racial justice, gender justice and economic justice. And our Migration and Europe programmes are current-day iteration of our racial justice commitment. The programme focuses on public discourse, on detoxifying public discourse and integration issues, seeking a migration policy which is both fair to migrants and to receiving communities. This is why we wholeheartedly endorse the conclusion in Liz Collett's excellent paper that you're going to hear about in just a minute, that successful integration is good for society as a whole and not just for migrants. The current speed and ferocity of the cuts to public spending and public services in the UK, together with an expected extended period of austerity and reduction in personal and family standards of living, are clearly going to affect everybody, well, nearly everybody, although the mantra that we're all in this together is we're wearing a little thin on some. However, no prizes for guessing that those on the lowest incomes and those most marginalised already are liable to be the worst hit. And that includes a significant proportion of low-paid migrants and established residents living on benefits, and the 10 million or so who live on incomes under 15,000 a year, sterling that is. These are the people with the least choices and, if you like, financial wiggle room, a significant number of whom are vulnerable to influence from the far right, as we know, unless we're able to create and sustain a better narrative about the benefits to us all of migration, not just to the better off, as many of those people would see it. Liz's papers, Liz Collette on my left, I'll introduce in a moment, her paper draws attention to what she calls integration fatigue in the UK, and this does illustrate the urgency with which new and creative ideas about public discourse are needed. The same old, is just not cutting it, which most people in this room know from your daily work. Integration budgets are an easy target for cuts, politically popular probably, but without sufficient thought to political, perverse and unintended consequences. And as in so many areas of early intervention, the consequences of withdrawal could be costly in the long run. And those costs could be far more important than mere financial ones, such as the need for more interpreters once English language classes have been withdrawn. Of greater significance for all of us in the room could be the profound and long-lasting impact on relationships between communities of people, seeing each other in a negative and mistrustful light. So what can we do? We're going to hear today from Liz about what's going on across Europe, and then we have three highly regarded respondents from whom we hope to hear some thoughtful, and we hope in particular, some hopeful and creative ideas about how we can collectively improve things. There's plenty of time for questions later on, as I mentioned, comments, exhortation probably from some, looking around the room, seeing who's here, and debate. And we'll draw to a close at 5, after which we have a networking reception until about 6, certainly 6 at the latest. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I hope you all gained something useful for your work from today. And I'm going to hand straight over to Elizabeth Collett, usually known as Liz, who's the senior advisor working on European policy for the Transatlantic Council, which is a project of the Migration Policy Institute, as probably everybody already realises. Liz is the author of this, Immigrant Integration in Europe in a Time of Austerity, also now available on their website, and she's going to talk us through some of the findings in here about what's going on across Europe.
Thank you. It says in the programme that I'll take half an hour, but I think I'll try and be brief so we can have more time for discussion. Thank you for the introduction, and as Sarah says, this is a follow-up investigation to an initial chapter in the Prioritising Integration book, which looked at the impact of the economic crisis and, more recently, the changes in political climate within Europe and the effect, ultimately, on integration funding. I managed to pick out the effects in 9 different member states across the European Union, trying to get a range from geographically and both in terms of size and experience with integration. And in short, the assessment is to ask whether policymakers have put their money where their mouth is. Are they matching what they say with what they do? And I think the headline answer to that is member state and European countries have been highly diverse in their responses to how they fund integration programming and how they will do in the future. And it's not enough just to look at the politics and economics in a particular country to understand why that might be. And we'll go into that. I think I should start first with a caveat that it's extremely difficult to compare and contrast different integration budgets in different countries. They are formulated very differently in most countries. There are very few centralized, easily distinguishable integration budgets. They're normally spread across 3, 4, maybe 5 ministries, including education, health, employment, and immigration. Some have some centralized agencies, others don't at all. And so this is less a compare and contrast in a direct sense and more offering a qualitative set of case studies individual to each country. So I think direct comparison would probably be a little too ambitious. In terms of how Europe has fared over the last few years, I think it's important to sort of set out the impact of the economic crisis on your government budgets across Europe. And it's notable that the aggregate government budget for EU member states, or 27 member states, the aggregate government budget deficit in the EU increased from less than 1% of GDP in 2007 to almost 7% of GDP in 2009. That is a dramatic shift in public debt, and some governments within that are even more extreme. You know, countries such as Ireland registered a deficit of 14.4% of GDP, minus 14.4% of GDP. The classic country, Greece, minus 15.4%. But other countries like Latvia registered minus 10.2%. And even here in the UK in 2009, the deficit was registered at around minus 11.4% of GDP. And this gives you an indication of the kinds of pressures governments are coming under, which has caused the majority of European governments within the last year to announce broad-range budget cuts. In terms of the labour market, the unemployment rate rose generally from 7% to 9.6% across the European Union between 2008 and 2010. But that pinch has been far from even. In some countries, and I'm sure we'll hear later about Spain, there has been a dramatic jump in unemployment rates, particularly for migrant workers. Whereas in Germany, unemployment levels actually dropped 0.7% in 2010. So they've actually seen a change in the other direction, that, albeit they're the only country in Europe that's seen a change in the other direction. In terms of migrant unemployment, generally proportionately affected, except for some outliers such as Spain and Ireland, but particularly affected are young males working in vulnerable sectors such as construction, agriculture. And there have been some policies to address this in a number of countries, which I'll come on to later. And at the same time, new immigration flows have dropped slightly in some countries. It's too early to really see the impacts because it takes a while for the data to catch up, but you're already seeing registrations of third country nationals in Ireland drop quite dramatically, and the same in Spain in terms of labour immigration. So the immigration flows are beginning to catch up. And this is set against a context of political change. Last year saw a series of elections in which far-right extremist groups made substantial gains. The Netherlands is the classic example, but also countries which were quite surprised by the outcome, such as Sweden. And this suggests that integration is becoming a hotter topic politically, and a number of political groups with strong views on integration have more of a stronghold in government. In terms of integration planning and funding, to come back to this, in the majority of European countries, integration funded is decided and coordinated at the national level. A number of countries have multi-year integration plans. The Portuguese National Plan of Immigrant Integration, for example, the Estonian Integration Strategy that runs from 2008 to 2013. These set ballpark budgets for activities and specific areas of activity over a series of years. But despite the strong national control, in a number of countries, regions and localities have a certain amount of discretion in how that money is spent, and certain, in some cases, their own budgets to spend on integration. This is clearly the case in Germany. It's almost exclusively the case in Belgium, where there is very little central government direction, and that's probably a good thing, considering the lack of government in Belgium right now. And also in countries such as Spain, where the regions have quite a lot of autonomy over how they spend on integration. Beyond this, there is also another stream of funding which has become increasingly important in recent years, and that's funding from the European Union. In some countries, such as Poland and Slovakia, integration funding is almost entirely co-funded by the European Union. And at regional and city levels, authorities are increasingly dependent on the various streams of funding from the EU. This is classically the European Integration Fund, which is an £825 million fund over a seven-year period. It's a small fund, but it's very focused. But it's also supplemented by broader social policy funds like the European Social Fund, Progress, the Regional Development Fund, and Urb Act, which all have various priorities in employment and urban development, but can be also applied to support the integration of immigrants. So turning a little to the country case studies. I looked at this in a combination of based on the severity of the recession, the nature of immigration to the country, but also the experience of that particular country in developing immigration policy. And I don't want to go through them all alphabetically. They're in the paper for those of you who are as nerdy as I. And just to say that the majority of the case studies were based on responses from members of the National Contact Points on Integration, which is an EU network of government officials responsible for integration at the national level. And that would be except for Denmark, Ireland and the UK. The others are all based on questionnaires. And a lot of desk research and some very long evenings spent trawling through Ministry of Finance websites, which I would not recommend anyone try and do if they value their sanity. So just to go into some broad brush, as I said before, there have been very diverse reactions across the EU, and you actually do see a number of positive trends. Good examples are, for example, in Portugal, which is a classic country one would have expected to have made severe cuts to its integration programming, given the severity of budget constraints in the country and the broad general budget cut that was taken last year. In fact, Portuguese spending has really maintained at a constant, and that is, I think, to great part due to the fact that they rely strongly on EU funding and use that as a way of drawing in co-funding from the national government, but also the fact that there is a set infrastructure, there is a very developed set of outlets and focal points in each town within Portugal which bring together different ministries and make it harder to dismantle that kind of integration funding. Another good example is Sweden, which at the end of last year actually announced an increase in spending specifically to improve labour market access. With the additional programming, migrants will be given individualised assessments of their skills and experience, put into language and vocational programmes with a view to getting them more quickly into the labour market. And that will mostly apply to new arrivals, but will be available to others as well. And that actually constitutes an increase in funding when fully operational of 900 million Swedish krona, which is around 15% of the total budget. So quite a substantial increase for a country like Sweden. And then also in Denmark, you see a slow increase in funding, which coincides with a number of policy changes which have good and bad implications in Denmark. In a number of other countries, you see the status quo. Countries holding firm on their integration policies. Germany is a good example that's made a broad budget cut last year, but has managed to retain the same amount of language funding and orientation funding at the federal level for integration, which I think is important given some of the political statements that were made a few months ago. Despite that, there is a serious commitment to integration that remains in Germany. The Czech Republic is another example that until now has not only retained its integration funding, but also put in place a number of emergency funds intended to try and improve labour market access for migrants. You will see labour market access is a strong theme amongst many of these countries. And I'm given to understand that this may not be able to continue in the future, that the Czech Republic will come under increasing pressure in the future and become more reliant on EU funding as a source of revenue for integration programming. But perhaps more interesting for this audience is what's happened where there have been severe cuts. In some countries, the cuts are really unsurprising, and Ireland has come under unprecedented pressure to institute budget cuts. And so you see cuts in terms of integration funding for migrant integration, roughly a halving of the budget for the Office of the Minister for Integration, and other areas slowly being drawn down in Ireland over the last 3 years, and that will have a particular knock-on effect for NGOs working in Ireland. And while that's not unexpected, given the severity of the recession in Ireland, it is interesting to note how much of the infrastructure has been affected, as well as the programming itself. And I think two of the most dramatic cuts have been the Netherlands and the UK. In the Netherlands, the cuts have been explicitly political and dramatic. Over the next 4 years, integration funding within the Ministry of Housing and Communities will drop by 80%. And that will be particularly affecting language programming and support for language. In the future, migrants will be expected to take out loans in order to fund their own language learning in the Netherlands, and that, we are given to understand, will be around in the region of 5,000 to 6,000 euros per person in terms of costs for language learning, which is quite a daunting prospect for someone who's newly arrived in a country and attempting to make a living. It's also having other effects in terms of funding to municipalities and regions, and some things which the Netherlands is known for being good at, which one of which was dialogue with migrant groups. There will no longer be funding for the dialogue structure with migrant groups, and that will be discontinued from next year. And that's something which, you know, even the EU has tried to mimic in its structure in the European Integration Forum. And then to take the UK, which is probably what you've all been waiting for. There has been no real coherent integration policy in the UK that you can see from the outside in the same way that you can see in other countries. And there's also been no explicit political reduction, but you see cuts across the board in a variety of areas. In communities and local governments, you've seen a general reduction in the money spent on policy areas like connecting communities, and specifically the Migration Impact Fund, which is actually derived from increases in visa fees for migrants. While they haven't explicitly or officially said what that money will be used for, my understanding is that based on statements in the most recent budget, that this will be applied to stronger border controls and immigration processing. At the same time, you're seeing cuts in ESOL funding and language cuts of about 50%. This is one of the assessments made by the London School of Economics. And cuts to the refugee integration policy in various areas. And this is just an example of the types of cuts that are being made across the board in the UK. So what are the drivers for these changes? I'd like to state from the outset that these are tentative thoughts. These are tentative suggestions of what the various drivers might be for the changes in Europe and the explanations, because, as I say, they are very different in different countries. It's obvious that politics has had an impact in some countries, such as the Netherlands. It's had no impact in others where one might expect a similar impact to take place. A good comparison is the Netherlands and Denmark. They've had very similar approaches to integration, very similar approaches, particularly with respect to the concept of self-help, that immigrants should be helping themselves to integrate, and the government is taking a back seat. However, in Denmark, integration funding has remained at the same level, while in the Netherlands, that has meant a slash in funding. So there's clearly something else going on apart from politics. Economics, one would expect all of those countries, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal, to make similar cuts in their budget, and actually there have been differentiated cuts to budgets across the board. I mean, you see Portugal really retaining a focus on integration funding despite those huge constraints. So economics alone doesn't seem to be explaining the changes over the last few years. So I'd like to suggest three other potential factors. And one of them is the philosophical commitment to immigrant integration in a particular country. How committed is that country to immigrants in the broader society? What view do they have of them as being long-term members of society, or are they more seen as a sort of short-term... I hesitate to use the word, but sort of short-term units of labour in a particular country and not seen as long-term members of that society, and how much that has an effect on integration. Countries like Germany, Denmark, Sweden seem to have made a philosophical decision early on that these will become members of society and they will continue these commitments financially. A second is more of a policy-related one, which is embeddedness. How deeply rooted are policies in the various ministries and government policies themselves? Portugal is an example here. There is a set infrastructure, and therefore it's harder to dismantle that the integration programming or draw it down. Whereas in other countries, and this is particularly the case with the newer member states, it's stalled an investment in that infrastructure and the development of infrastructure in a lot of new member states where countries were considering developments. They've now put a hold on those until they're more certain of the financial future in particular countries. So there's a certain embeddedness of policy within the broader governance of immigration and integration. And finally, as Sara mentioned, the idea of integration fatigue. And I think this may apply to the UK and the Netherlands particularly. These are countries with long experience of integration, and yet the sense that long investments haven't realised returns in integration and a sense of impasse. Where do we go next? And this is a deeper psychological challenge for governments. And I think it's important to look at how the UK and the Netherlands react in the future because other countries may follow suit if they in turn don't see the same returns to their investments in terms of immigrant integration. I do have a couple of observations to finish up with, which I'll just go through quickly. Some countries have stuck to long-term priorities, and this seems to be important to really know what your goals are and know what you expect from integration policies. And this is particularly in the case of labour market access, and an increased focus on labour market access seems to be extremely important in those countries which have retained integration funding. Demonstrating the economic benefits of integration is an important part of the politics. EU funding seems to have played a critical role, and I believe will play a stronger role in the future as budgets continue to come under more and more pressure. Mainstreaming has become a stronger feature of integration funding, and I think that can have a good and a bad component. A good component if economies of scale are found and migrants can be brought into broader policies that can still benefit them. But mainstreaming in name only, the type of mainstreaming where a department is given additional responsibility and yet no support to fulfil that responsibility, is the type of mainstreaming I think governments should be trying to avoid. Local impacts, I think, are still playing out. There's a trickle-down effect of budget cuts on regions and cities, which I think will be felt for a long while, and an increasing tension between national governments and regional governments, where national governments are setting the budget structures and regional governments are trying to make do while still feeling the very strong impacts of immigrant integration. I think civil society actors are particularly vulnerable in this environment, and in that respect, foundations and other non-governmental actors are going to become more important and may have to consider almost an emergency role to fill some of the gaps and sustain some of the civil society actors who are most important in the area. And a final thought is the idea that over the last decade, you've seen a lot of policy experimentation in a number of countries, a lot of trying new things just to see if they work. This has particularly been the case in places like Sweden and the Netherlands. This will become less prevalent as time goes on and people will stick to tried and tested policies and approaches. And I think it's still important to think of new ways of framing and implementing various aspects of immigrant integration as we go forward and not be stuck in the safe routes because it's an economically volatile period of time. I think I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you very much. A masterly canter through a very, very interesting read. Thanks, Liz. I've been just reminded that before everybody starts to give their views, that we're recording this session and that will be then made available online. So you might want to just bear that in mind, because I will be asking people to say who they are and where they're from. And I hope that won't curtail too much of the conversation, but you can't... it's very difficult to do these things with Chatham House rules and go transparent on them, although people are welcome to not say who they are, I suppose, if they want to say something controversial. And just a couple of housekeeping... we're not expecting a fire alarm, and we are quite high up here. So if the bell goes, we just run for the front door and into the street, straight down. And the toilets are all the way down in the basement. Sorry about that. Okay, we're going to move straight on to a panel discussion, three respondents, rather, and then have a discussion afterwards. Let me introduce our three contributors. Probably well known to many of you. On my far left is Trevor Phillips, who's the chairman of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which, as for benefit of our overseas guests, is the overall umbrella for human rights and equalities issues regulation. It combined its three predecessor separate organisations on gender, race, and
disability.
And now also includes sexual orientation, age, and faith. So Trevor was many years ago, in the latter part of my student days, the president of our student union, and he's had a very long career both in politics and in and in and in media broadcasting, I suppose, for want of a better term. On my immediate right is Nicholas Marigan. He's the director of the Spanish Observatory on Racism and Xenophobia in the Ministry of Labour and Immigration in Spain, obviously. And he led the integration work of the recent Spanish presidency. And he's going to talk to us about the Spanish experience, although he may stray beyond that if he feels so inclined. And on my far right, I'm sure I don't need to introduce, but I will anyway, Dimitri Papadimitriou from the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, the author of literally hundreds of books and the venerable advisor to many governments around the world, and including many of ours here in Europe. We're very deeply honoured to work with you and to welcome you here today. Taking it straight from the, shall I say, my far left?
Oh, why not?
Thank you very much, Sarah, and it's a privilege to be on this platform, and I just want to say thanks to Barrett Cadbury and colleagues for making it possible. I'm going to... The main event here are the other three on this platform, so there are enough people in the room who have heard me say much of what I'm going to say many times, so I'm going to try and make it brisk, though perhaps in a slightly different way. I want to address four essential points which in a way grow out of Liz's analysis, one which relate particularly to the UK, though I think it will be clear as we talk about it that a lot of the underlying questions, though not the context, are very similar across the North America and Europe. I want to address four things. First of all, history. Second, some paradoxes. Thirdly, the issue of public resource, which Liz has given us some really interesting figures on. And fourthly, what's next? The reason I think history is important is because, certainly in this country, it conditions not just our understanding, but our public debate. Without going into tedious detail, there are various things that one is not allowed to say. There are various things which, in a rational world, would seem utterly anodyne and unexceptional. But when applied to the issues of immigration and, because of our particular history, allied questions of race identity become and are thought of as exceptionally controversial. And as I'll go on to say in a moment, people have public arguments even when they are violently agreeing. On the issue of history, I think that the essential point here is that for most of my lifetime, the question of immigration was essentially a racial one, and that is particularly to do with our history, which is that immigration until the 90s essentially meant the absorption of people from empire who were different colour, though actually, by and large, not a massively dissimilar culture, if we take by culture to mean habits, expectations, faith, groups of faith, and so on. They were not unknown. Of course, that has changed over the last 15 years, where the more substantive flows have been European, plus, of course, not empire, not British Empire, Third World, developed countries. But essentially, the effect of this has been to strip the question of immigration, not completely, but substantially, of racial connotation. Or, to be more precise, it is no longer a purely racial question. And that, of course, is reflected in the way the consensus about government policy, which is now really much more focused on migration as an economic factor, point system, and all of that. I think the second thing I want to say about history is that when we think about the issue of immigrant integration, the learning in this country which we don't often articulate, but actually is really rather powerful, is that we, over the last 30 to 40 years, have come to understand some things about the nature of migrant communities which aren't necessarily obvious. And what I'm about to say will seem utterly obvious, but if you look back at the writings and on this in this country, it isn't it doesn't seem obvious to people at the time, and that is that migrant communities change and become like the settled communities at very different rates. Some do not move at all, some move very, very rapidly, and they move in slightly different ways. The history of the East African Asians, which is less than 50 years old, is very different to, let us say, history of Caribbeans in this country, which is not much longer, and we now have means to measure what we would consider success, what we would consider, and I'm slightly jumping ahead of myself to talk about the definition of integration, the degree to which they have become like the settled communities. So the issue of the speed at which different communities move to become like what they have discovered is extremely important, because it conditions people's understanding of how you deal with immigrant integration. If you think that characteristically immigrants can become acclimatized and acculturated really fast, you have one approach. If you think actually it's a rather slow process, or you need to do special things, then you take a whole other approach. Third point I want to make in relation to history is that what has been extremely crucial to the understanding and handling of immigration has been the speed of arrival, or speed of flow, to be more precise. We know that in different parts of the country, attitudes towards immigration are completely different. A lot of that is entirely correlated, and quite a lot of work has been done on this, with speed with which the composition, ethnically particularly, of the area is changing. And the last point I want to make is, of course, that in the last 10 years, all of these questions have been shrouded, I think is the right word, in a sometimes befuddling mist of concern about the relationship between immigration and security. And some of this, I think, surfaced in the Prime Minister's recent speech in Munich, in which, in my view, a lot of what he said was entirely rational, but it appeared not to be that rational because it wasn't entirely... Well, it's quite clear if you read the speech, but from the way it was spun and reported, it wasn't entirely clear where he was referring to labour market immigration and its effects and how we deal with it and its relationship to security. So there are a whole series of historical issues that both cloud or certainly colour the way we talk about these issues. Secondly, I'd like to put a couple of paradoxes, I suppose, on the table. As I said, I think we've moved towards thinking, broadly speaking, in this country, as the driver for inward migration, as economic. That, in a sense, is a good thing insofar as it de-racializes the question. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that people, for the reasons I've given already, think of all immigrants as the same, or simply calculate their attitudes towards immigrants basically on economic need. Second paradox we have is that it's well documented that here there are very different attitudes towards the idea of immigration generally and the perceived impact locally. Most people think they have no particular problem with immigration in their area, but they think that immigration is a massive problem for the country as a whole. Here, the interpolation of the media is important, but I don't think it is entirely down to the media. Third paradox, which appears to be emerging, was very clearly indicated in work that was published Well, it was conducted for Searchlight, the leading, I guess, anti-racist organisation, last week. I mean, I think there are lots of arguments about the methodology of this piece of work and the way it was explained and so on. But I think that one of the most striking things is that it set out very clearly something which I think a lot of people in this room know intuitively, and that is that perhaps the most hawkish group, anti-immigrant groups, are last-wave immigrants. And there are all sorts of hypotheses one can apply to this, but I think it's an important issue, and it will become an important political question if it can be demonstrated that there is essentially anti-immigrant sentiment is clearly no longer racialized. The fourth point I want to address in this sort of paradox is I like Liz's description of the turn to self-help. I think this is going to be very important, actually, because as we move to a slightly more liberal view, I think people will start to translate their anxiety about immigration less into "we don't like immigrants," but more into, okay, this is here are some conditions under which it's okay for people to be here. And we're beginning to see this in as the public spending cuts start to bite, one of the first things that starts to go, it's not important financially, but it has become important symbolically, translation services. Why do we need to translate? Why can't they learn English? And can't their friends teach? All that sort of stuff. I think these things are going to become extremely important. And the last paradox is a huge political paradox, is that parties of the centre-left have to behave as being tougher on immigration, actually, than parties of the centre-right. And I'm speaking relative to their past positions. I think the coalition is making far less noise about immigration, actually, than Labour did for substantial parts of its period in government. I can expand on that if we want, but I think that is to do with the salience of immigration as an electoral issue, and where the left and the right feel they've got to position themselves. 2 points on public expenditure and what now. And public expenditure, it's obviously already a real issue. It was already an issue before the spending review, before the cuts, because it has become clear over the last 3 years that the real pressure point in terms of the flow of inward migration is not actually on jobs. It is not even on housing. It is on infrastructure, by which I mean schools, health service, transport. And for the best indicator of this is the concern and the anxiety and actually the amount of resource local authorities are spending on getting the government to acknowledge and accept the number of immigrants that are in their areas. It is a huge deal for them. Secondly, in relation to public expenditure, Liz has already talked about reductions, but I think what we may also begin to see is failures of public service, which are actually to do with failures of reform or lack of resource, beginning to be attributed to pressure from migration. And we're already, there's signs from this from members of Parliament. And the last point I want to make in relation to the issue of public expenditure and public resource is I think that a lot of the argument about multiculturalism, which David Cameron defines as state multiculturalism, isn't really about identity at all. It is actually more about the boundaries of the public and the private. And it is really an argument about what is it that the state should be doing? At what level should it be intervening to solve problems? I think, and that's why you have a slightly bizarre situation in which the Prime Minister makes a speech in which, if you read the words, they are ABC. You read the Deputy Prime Minister's speech, you read the words, and they are ABC and a half, maybe. But these are represented as contested views. Actually, in relation to identity and multiculturalism, they're not. But I think there may be an argument here about the role of the state. And I suspect that public sector spending, public expenditure reductions and so on, is going to sharpen that argument. And the language may become about immigrants and how much they're using it, but it's really a different sort of argument. Finally, what next? I think if there's a big thing we have to do now, when we're thinking about immigrant integration, I think we have to change this argument a bit. In this country, immigrant integration is taken to mean, can we get people to like each other? Actually, I think that is less important than ever. I think what is important is that people should share, should be able to share experiences and share opportunity. When I was at the Commission for Racial Equality, we essentially created a formula in which integration equaled equality, participation and interaction. I think that there's a confusion about the question of whether integration means that people of different kinds must like each other, or whether what we're really talking about is equal access, equality of opportunity, people being able to share similar experiences socially and culturally and so on. My view is if we could get the argument onto the second, it would be more practical and useful, and that means that we need to be thinking much more scientifically about the issues of measurement. And my last point is that we talk a lot about government, we talk a lot about public service. I think when we think about integration, we have to think a lot more about the role of the private sector. The Commission last year published a report on the meatpacking industry. One of the things that most shocked me was to discover that a number of food processing factories, it is routine practice to separate factory shifts by nationality. Why? Because it works. It adds to your productivity. You don't have to talk to the Lithuanians and the Poles and the Russians together. At 4 o'clock, the language of the factory can be in Lithuanian. At 12 o'clock, it can be in Russian. There's a town in the north of Scotland near Fraserburgh where hardly anybody lives, except now 600 Russians who are cleaning fish. It's a big issue, which I think we're going to have to deal with, encounter, think about, address how we're going to address, how we're going to manage it.
Gosh, that was packed a lot in there. Thank you very much. Lots of interesting food for thought, and I'm sure other people will have plenty to come back on that later. I'm going to move straight to Nicholas, who's going to talk to us about the Spanish experience, in particular some of the work that you did under the presidency. Mm-hmm. But feel free to comment more broadly if you'd like.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to the Barrow Cadbury Trust for inviting me, and the Transatlantic Council on Migration and the Migration Policy Group. It is, as Trevor said, it is a privilege for me to be here, and I'm really honored. And I'll try to explain the Spain situation, the Spain scenario on integration within the crisis, and then I'll give a few notes, as it has been said, on the outcomes from the ministerial conference that was done during the Spanish presidency on Zaragoza on the first semester of 2010. Well, the Spanish scenario, of course, it has been a great impact on integration policies the last 2 years and a half, the last 2 years. And I'll try to explain first what the scenario in general, the changes in the last 20, 15, 10 years, what we have done, the legal instruments and other instruments we have created, and then explain how this scenario is changing, and then I'll give a few notes on Zaragoza, on the ministerial presidency. Well, the immigration screening increase in Spain in the last decade has passed from, in 1997, there were 650,000 immigrants. That was 2% of the Spanish population. On the 31st of December 2010, it was almost 5 million people, 5 million immigrants in the Spanish scenario, which was 12% of the population. There's two ways of measuring them and giving you the resident permits data. And there's another way we measure it, which is the census. Then if we look at the census, we'll have more, almost 6 million immigrants. If we look at the resident permits, we'll have almost 5 million immigrants. The changes in the last 15, 20 years have been tremendous, but now I'll try to explain the changes on immigrant population within the financial crisis the last 2 years. On the last 2 years, there has been not quite a big change. I mean, though, as Liz said, the big increase on unemployment on the whole of Spanish population, the big increase on unemployment on the immigrant population, there hasn't been a big shift on immigrant. I mean, immigrant population, the entry has decreased, but there's a big change. For example, from Latin Americans, the mainly countries of origin we have in Spain is people from Ecuador, from Colombia, and Peruvians. Well, for example, in 2008, there were about 400,000 Ecuadorians, and now there's about 370,000 Ecuadorians. So there has been a decrease mainly in Latin Americans, and there has been an increase in Europeans, people from the United Kingdom, from Italy, from Bulgaria, and also from Romania. There has been an increase within the last 3 years. So the scenario in the last 10 years is that the proportion of foreigners has changed, and it has been has reached the higher range among the European Union countries in Spain. But now this immigrant population has decreased, the unemployment has increased. I mean, for example, 3 years ago the unemployment figures in Spain was 8% for the total population. Now it's close to 20%. Immigrant unemployment is close to 30%, but youth unemployment rates are close to 40%. And I want to mix this with another figure, which is the increase of the number of persons reluctant to immigration. I think it was very important what Trevor says about the attitudes, in this case of Spaniards, toward immigration. We do a survey every year, and the changes we are experimenting, they're big. But I think the scenario is very similar to what Trevor said, because if we ask, we do every year, we ask about 3,000 Spaniards, what do you think about the government policy on immigration? And they're getting more and more reluctant. We ask them, what do they think about the number of immigrants we have in Spain? And they're getting more and more reluctant. But then we ask them about living together questions, what do they think about living together in immigrants? And the answers are very tolerant. So the questions are very different depending on what you ask. But I think another clue other than that is employment rates. It's unemployment, because if we know who we ask, we are asking, I mean, for example, young people, we ask like 50 questions to Spaniards about what they think of migration, and then we divide them. We, depending on the answers, we divide them on tolerant people, reluctant people, and ambivalent. Well, the big change has been on young people. If you ask people under 25, what do you think about migration? Years ago, they were very tolerant. They were thinking about a world without frontiers. They were thinking about a very tolerant way. But now, unemployment rate in youngsters is about 40%. So their answers are completely different. In the last three years, youngsters have changed from a tolerant position to a very ambivalent, and especially if they have an unemployment experience. Well, having said that, what have been our policy changes and how our policy is changing? Well, I think the Spanish government commitment to integration of immigrants and in general to human rights, it's a big commitment. For example, in the last reform of the Immigration Act, of the immigration law, the government established a new article on integration of immigrants, having a commitment from the government to maintain the fund for the integration of immigrants and maintaining the integration plan at a legal level, so that it is difficult for different governments to change this policy that has been created in the last year. Well, as Liz said, commenting on the different integration plans in Europe, Spain did an integration plan for the years 2007-2010, which was based in three principles: in the principle of equality, principle of citizenship, and I think saying our strategic plan was a plan for citizenship is a way of committing for immigrants to be part of the citizenship. And we thought we realized we were aware of the word, and it was a word of commitment. And the other principle is principle of interculturality. I mean, we didn't want to talk about multiculturality. We thought about interculturality, of thinking about more mixture of the different people, not only based on respect, but based on respect and also on trying to get people together and getting people mixed. Well, as Liz says, in Europe, there are different, the commitment, talking about integration of immigrants policies are very different. In Spain, the policy of the government is very important, but Spain is a very decentralized country, as Liz said, and the policies of the different regional governments is also very important. Regional governments now suppose more than 40% of the public expenditure. So it is very important what regional governments do also on integration. That's why it's important the integration fund that has been established by law, because the integration fund establishes a coordinated way of funding integration between the state, the regional governments, and municipalities. There are several ministries involved, mainly the Ministry of Labour and Immigration, which changed before all the integration policies were in the Ministry of Interior, and they have changed to the Ministry of Labour, and the Ministry of Health, Social Issues, and Equality. It used to be a Ministry of Equality because that was one of the measures of the financial crisis. The Ministry of Equality was no more existent and became a part of the Ministry of Healthcare. The budget had a big increase. From 2006 to 2009, the budget each year was more than 400 million euros, and we have spent in the last 5-6 years more than 2,000 million euros on integration policies. We are doing the strategic plan was from the year 2007-2010. We are now evaluating the plan and try to see what everything was done and how the expenditure was done. So all the figures I sent to Liz were not completely up to date, because we only have the figures for the years 2007, 2008, and mainly 2009. But there's so many actors, the ministries, the regional governments, the local governments, the NGOs, that we're still evaluating all what it's suspended. But now, and within the evaluation process, we are doing the new plan. And the new plan, it's good to see where are we and where are we going, and what are we trying to do, and what is the new scenario. It's a good way to try to analyze what's happening. Well, we have had several, within a participation process, several meetings with regional governments, with local governments, with NGOs, with migrant associations, with universities, trying to see what are the new priorities for the Spanish scenario, especially with a big unemployment rate, with the lower number of immigrants coming to our country. So now things have changed, and for example, a lot of the plan and integration policies was spent on reception on immigrants. Some years we received more than 300,000 immigrants every year, so there was a lot of spend on reception, and now reception is not such a priority. The biggest expenditure was done on education policies and on employment policies. So, and these two policies remain. The importance has been remain all the participation processes we're having. Everybody wants those two policies to be the two ones where we spend more. But the two new ones that people, that NGOs, migrant associations, universities, regional and local governments want the coordination mechanisms to be spent more are mainly combating racism and xenophobia and conviviality living together programs. About conviviality living together programs, we're doing pilot projects both in the areas of Andalusia and in Catalonia, where there's the biggest unemployment rates, the biggest percentage of immigrant population, and we're trying to do some pilot projects to how to spend more and to focus more on places where there are big unemployment rates and some problems of conviviality. And the other focus is human rights in general. The government approved a human rights plan at the end of 2008, and also the strategic plan on citizenship and integration mentioned. There's also an action plan to improve living standards of the Roma population. And he has just passed a draft of Integral Act of Equal Treatment and Against Discrimination. The government has just passed this act. There has been a lot of criticism, especially from the far-right press and other far-right political parties. I think it is a very ambitious act, a very ambitious law, like creating an independent high authority. And I'm glad that Trevor's here, because the model set in the UK is the model the government wants to follow, with some variations, but mainly to combat discrimination in different terms like age, race, disability, gender, sexual orientation, or some new ones like illness. And now we're having the report for the Forum for the Integration of Immigrants and for the Council for Equal Treatment on this law. But these were the main things I wanted to comment you on the scenario. And I just wanted to comment now some small things of what was based the Ministerial Presidents on Spain on integration of immigrants, that then was a declaration passed by the Europe's Council. And European ministers basically agree to follow on the policy integration in the different areas to have a mainstreaming approach to develop of the consensus on the concept that was called the human capital by ensuring a cross-sectorial approach covering education, employment, etc. The ministers thought, and I think in this new scenario was important, to recognize the positive aspects of migration, especially in the context of the economic and financial downturn within Europe, and to continue to promote methods that help to fight racism and xenophobia and all forms of discrimination in our societies. I think this was a good thing to stress, especially in the new scenario that Liz was commenting and Liz was explaining. Other things that ministers agreed was to involve civil society and recognize the role of civil society and especially of migrant associations in these policies, to strengthen local initiatives and civic participation. One thing I didn't tell you about Spanish policy, that the ministry, the new Director General for Integration of Immigrants that was created, basically tried to support their policy on both NGOs and migrant associations and local governments, thinking that integration of immigrants is a local thing. Sorry to go back to the Spanish policy. And the other thing the ministers agreed at Zaragoza during the Spanish presidency was to promote the launching of a pilot project with a view to the evaluation of integration policies. The project was based on four areas: on employment, education, social inclusion, and active citizenship. I think it's a very focused project, which is very interesting. And after this meeting, next Wednesday, I'm going to, within the program of national contact points that Liz said, I'm the Spanish national contact point on integration, and we're having a meeting next Wednesday in Brussels, because Eurostat has launched the report on how this project that was approved in Zaragoza, that was approved in the Spanish presidency, that in this area has some indicators like, well, the different employment rates, unemployment rates, activity rates between the immigrant population and the total population, or other education indicators, or social inclusion indicators like the median net income or the risk poverty rate, and especially some indicators which I think are very interesting to see the integration of immigrants, like the active citizenship indicators, which are, for example, the share of immigrants that have acquired citizenship, comparing the different member states in Europe, the different countries, how are they acquiring citizenship, and the share of immigrants holding permanent or long-term resident permits, or the share of immigrants among elected representatives. I think that was all I needed to say, and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Well, thank you very much. A very interesting quick tour around the whole of the Spanish scene, and very interesting as well to hear that last little piece about the presidency, and I'm sure that lots of people in this room are anxious to read what comes out of that evaluation. And thanks very much for your contribution to that. Third contribution, final contribution from this side of the table before we open it up to Dimitri. I think a lot of people here know you, and I've already introduced you, and we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. I'm glad you didn't say the far right.
No, I was very careful not to say that.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I should probably speak a little louder. Sorry, I have a bit of a cold. It's a pleasure to be here. I've enjoyed the partnership with your institution, and of course, AISA has been a terrific partner on the ground. And thank you for the kind introduction. I'm also glad, very glad, because I know now what I need to be asking, my friend Trevor, protection, because I now fit under one, at least one perhaps, of your three portfolios. So whenever I have complaints, I'll come to you. Can you reach across the Atlantic?
For you, anything, Dimitri.
Thank you. So what I'm going to try to do here is depress you. I'm sorry. Depress you. tell you that things are, you know, at least as worrisome as you may have gathered, and in all probability more worrisome, which means that at the end of this conversation, you know, and after we have had a drink together and all that, you should go back and work harder, because that's what we all have to do when things, you know, are particularly bad. Now, if you choose to go and hide under a rock, that's also, you know, a possibility, but we don't recommend that. I'll talk, sort of pull back, as it were, a little bit, and talk about the recession, because, in a sense, that's when our problem started. It's also the theme of the book that we're releasing today. But I will very quickly sort of talk about the implications of the Great Recession for the kinds of issues that I presume we all care about, which is not just immigrants, although immigrants is the topic, but essentially, you know, people who get disproportionately hurt in economic climates like the one that we've had in the last couple of years, and in times that follow those economic climates. And I'll say a few things about the Great Recession, about a few things about the ongoing and long-term consequences, particularly how they would be felt by groups that matter to all of us. And then I'll close by raising three questions that concern me about immigrants. So I'll get to immigrants in the beginning and at the end of my comments. And as my colleagues have already said, in a sense, we're in a pincer movement, if you will. We are on both sides. We're looking at two major issues, two realities. The first one is that the needs for integration, which typically gets reduced to funding, to money, but it is much more than money. Money is a lubricant. I learned that word at lunch. Thank you, Sarah. in a different context, of course. But it's much more than the money. It's, you know, attitudes, the public mood, the how smart we can be, you know, in terms of keeping communities together. You know, we typically think that immigrant integration is something that we're going to do to them. Sometimes people, some of whom oppose immigration or great openings to immigration, say, no, you have to look at the issue from the lens of the existing community. I think the proper way, of course, is to look at the issue in terms of living together. How can we live together in ways that can actually make us, you know, propel us, move us forward, build on the human capital, build on the imagination, build on the institutions, build on the imagination of all of the people at the community level, the local level, as perhaps some people talk about. And the second reality is that there is both a reduced capacity, but more importantly, a reduced willingness to invest public funds to do some of the things that we've been accustomed to be doing with public spending. And this, of course, comes in the midst of, you know, a very much soured public mood about immigration. And we heard, you know, I mean, my friend Nicholas is always wonderful because he lives these things every day, but the fact is that whether you're talking about Spain or the UK or my own country, I'm talking about the United States, not my country of birth, let alone my country of birth. there are things that are happening on the ground, you know, that if we can't somehow address them smartly, they can easily get out of hand. And immigrants, of course, will be hurt. But I think in the long-term society will be hurt. So the recession has had a highly differentiated effect or effects in different parts of Europe and across the Atlantic. So it's very difficult to generalize, but, you know, I never learn I will generalize, and then you'll say, well, but this isn't exactly right for Germany, or, you know, province 17 from country X, you know, didn't really exhibit any of this. But again, sort of broadly, we have to acknowledge that the effects were very diverse, and they affected disproportionately immigrants, immigrant origin communities, and minority occupations. Minority populations, exactly the groups that typically, you know, suffered disproportionately during bad times. The hardest hit in terms of the employment effects of inflation were men, three groups, youth, and, of course, minorities and immigrants. Now, the men, it makes sense. This recession, of course, was highly targeted. Not every sector got hit, but the sectors that got hit disproportionately were the sectors in which these three groups were disproportionately employed in. You know, whether it's the construction sector in Ireland, in the United States, in Spain and elsewhere, or manufacturing pretty much throughout Europe, with possible exception, I think we just all love to look at the exceptions. I love to look at the similarities. Everybody thinks that somehow, you know, Germany not only escaped a bullet, but somehow now is on an easy street. The fact is that German banking institutions are in real trouble. And when the banking system is in real trouble, that's almost with a 2 year, in a sense, 2 years later than everybody else, the Main Street industry and people begin to feel it down the road. But nonetheless, Germany took a big hit, a very short hit, and got out of the recession earliest and fastest. But we'll see what may or may not happen. The youth, you heard the numbers. The numbers that Nicholas talked, 40%. In Sweden, 37%. In Canada, 28%. In the United States, 24%. I'll discuss the implication of having, you know, youth not being able to get its foot into the labor force in a minute. And, of course, minorities and immigrants, over 30% in the case of Spain. In places like Sweden, you know, we all love to think that Sweden is somehow an outlier in the positive sense, but massive unemployment rates, you know, in terms of the immigrant and minority or immigrant origin population, which, of course, as I will discuss in a while, creates, you know, sort of fuels this unhappiness, both with our government, but also with visible minorities and immigrants of all types. One exception, there's always a little bit of good news in every bad story, women. And again, women have done well for the obvious reasons. They concentrate in caregiving and health care, et cetera, et cetera. These are occupations that even in the United States, that has had massive unemployment by American standards, have continued to grow. There has not been a single month since the beginning of the recession that the health care has not gained 10, 12, 30,000 jobs. And so that we don't all confuse each other, look under your public statistics, the ones that get announced by, you know, by individual member states or Eurostat. They don't mean what they say. They measure something other than what the average person on the street thinks. They measure unemployment on the basis of this fairly structured or restrictive criteria of who's an unemployed. You have to have looked actively for a job for the measurement period right before in order for you to be counted as unemployed, which masks underemployment and masks people who have left the labor force simply because they do not believe that they will find a job. Now, it may not hold in every country in the exact same definition, but most of our countries, now that I've had to look at this over the past 2 years, I realize, use the same things. By the measure of official unemployment in the United States, we have about 9% unemployment now. It's about 14 million people who are unemployed. But the real, the hidden unemployment, what we call the discouraged workers and the involuntarily partially employed, is close to 17%. 17% is about of the American labor force, is about 24 million people. Just do the math, what it would take if you were a politician or an economist, what it would take in terms of job creation in order to bring the unemployment down to a politically acceptable level that then allows you to be forward-looking in terms of immigration and other kinds of public expenditures. But that's the reality of it. So what's happening now, a year after most everybody, and now even Spain has gotten out of the recession? Well, the economists are still sputtering, with the possible exception, again, of our friends in Germany. But it's also very clear that the fiscal woes are going to become more and more important in the future. And countries that are really in the forefront of what has happened in terms of the crisis and its after effects and its effect on people, the countries that we've been talking about here, are the ones that are actually faring the worst in terms of the fiscal woes. Think of Greece, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, and the UK, perhaps a bit self-imposed, or much self-imposed because of public sector cuts. In the United States, it's easy to think of the United States as, you know, some sort of a big country, but it's composed of states. The states with the highest unemployment, double-digit unemployment, also have the largest deficits. The five states, California, Illinois, et cetera, with the major, the most unemployment and other fiscal problems, have a deficit this year of close to $30 billion. In the United States, states constitutionally, by their own state constitutions, are not allowed to have deficits, which means next year they're going to have to find $30 billion in cuts, which then means we're going to find ourselves where the UK voluntarily is placing itself in, public sector cuts, massive public sector cuts. And we're going to start with teachers. We already have. Tens of thousands of teachers have lost jobs. And you know what effect that has in the future. And the third by-effect or by-product of the Great Recession is something that I and a few others call economic scarring. And economic scarring is a sort of a really dangerous kind of concept. You know, it sort of undercuts, undermines society. There are two or three groups that will have already are showing the effects of this economic scarring. Long-term unemployed, first and foremost among them. Because we have evidence now from Sweden, from the United States, from Canada, from New Zealand, and I'm sure that, you know, sort of research, as we all know, you know, that gets done and produces interesting results in one place, you know, sort of gets done in a different place, and the results tend to be very, very similar. People who lose their jobs during recessions almost never catch up with their cohorts, people who did not lose their job during a recession. In the United States, it takes 3 decades for the catching up to take. As you know, most of these, you know, in 3 decades, most people will have left the labor force. And that is something that would be troubling, should be troubling to everyone, because it implies that a fairly large proportion of the people who lost their jobs during this recession or in the, you know, what comes after the recession will never be able to go back to the social standing, social and economic standing that they had before the recession.
And I'm saying never. I'm sure some will. The vast majority won't. There's something else that happens to these people. Their skills degrade. And that's also extremely dangerous. They become less interested, less interesting to employers, because employers have moved on. Part of what employers did during the recession was to rationalize further, to actually mechanize further, to computerize further, and of course to outsource jobs. You can see the vicious cycles, you know, sort of begin to play themselves out. And that is, you know, highly troubling to me. I think that it will be highly troubling to all of us. And, of course, youth. We talked about youth. And that's both youth and first-time labor force entrants, which, of course, also includes, you know, new immigrants who come to join their families, et cetera, et cetera. They find an environment that they haven't experienced during the last generation. That means, you know, people graduate from school, whether it's high school or whatever you call it, you know, in different parts, gymnasiums, et cetera, or from universities, which in the past had been sort of like the way that you move forward in life. And they don't find a job. And they stay out of the labor force for a year. Next year, they're competing with all of the people who also just graduated. And basically, you build in every year that happens, that passes. You have more and more youth who really cannot find their way into the labor force. And we know what happens to those young people, or at least what can happen, that they become fairly easy victims to demagogues and populists, because they're all, everybody, you know, these people are trying to figure an answer. Why us? How come? You know, there was an implicit contract. You know, I go, I pay my dues, I study, I come out, I fall into a midlife, into a mid, you know, middle class kind of a job. This is not happening throughout so many of our countries. This creates an enormous, in a sense, confidence deficit, and then a political deficit in which the ruling classes and the people who have jobs are on the one side, and you have all of those people who become the great disaffected. It can lead to a lost generation, which is a big, difficult thing for us to deal with. I'll close with three questions for all of us about immigrants. I think Lisa's paper shows that in some instances, cutting integration budgets has been long, essentially, you know, low-hanging fruit. It's an easy thing to cut. There isn't really that much of a constituency for it. If you want to talk about, you know, political pain at the polls, immigrants, you know, in most instances cannot vote, et cetera, et cetera. The United States is beautiful when it comes to those things. It picks on people who can't, who don't have power, and it basically says, you know what, you no longer have benefits. We did that in 1996. You know, we cut $44 billion off of the back of immigrants because they can't vote. Second question mark and problem that I see is that easily immigrants can be blamed for all of this. There is blame, plenty of blame to go around, but I don't think it is immigrants. And I think we can imagine who are to be blamed about all of this. And the third question that I think we all need to be thinking about and confront, we all know that some immigration, I'm sorry for not being an enthusiast for massive immigration, but some immigration is in our future, and I don't care whether in the UK, you're in Greece, you're in anywhere, you know, some immigration will continue to have to happen. It's essential. We're all getting older, none of you, but me, I'm getting older. And with all due respect to families, you know, here, I don't know how to be delicate about this. We are not, our fertility rate, trying to be polite, you know, is not what it used to be. So in many countries, you know, total fertility rate has gone the other direction. Somebody's going to have to do the jobs in order to pay the taxes that will keep all people like me, you know, sort of alive for a while longer. So that is a serious issue, because if we blame immigrants too much, if we fail when we target integration funds, we basically borrow against the future, because it makes it more difficult for communities to get along together. All of those things tie the hands of a future generation of politicians who will need to open up further to immigration in order for our societies to go forward. That may very well be, you know, the most dangerous thing that may happen as a result of this election. Sorry, I've talked for too much.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much. Someone said to me, I only met Dimitri today, and somebody said to me, you know, you'll be absolutely fascinated. He never, ever forgets the human story, and that's it's like listening to a storyteller. Thank you very much for that, and the exhortation to work harder. I hope I really pick that up. just a couple of comments. We will make sure everyone's invited here. We're organising to bring Michael Mendelssohn over, who was a Treasury Minister in Ontario during the public sector cuts in the 1990s, and he has another story to tell about that, and we're bringing him over in May, so watch out for an invitation to that. And just one comment on that you, and as you've only just arrived, you may not have read about this, but you were talking about skills degradation, and there was a poll, results of a poll announced yesterday, that the overwhelming proportion of the private sector don't think any public sector workers have got any skills worth buying. And that's really, it's, perhaps I put it rather too humorously, but it's really very, very worrying, especially for some of our towns and cities that are very, very dependent on public sector jobs, and that's the skills that people have got. Okay, well, thank you very all of the panellists for those contributions, which we will thank you in the traditional way at the end. But we have now got 50 minutes for an open debate. Just to remind you, though, that it is being it will go online and it recorded. So, any questions or comments from the floor? Who's going to start us off? Over here, thank you. Bring the microphone. Can you tell us, if you're willing to, who you are and where you're from?
Kjartan Svensson from the Runnymede Trust. I've got a question for Liz, actually. I don't know if you've seen the results from the MIPEX that were published last week. I've got some copies of the books if anyone's interested in having it. Runnymede is the national partner for that. Now, the trends that they identify there, obviously this is a snapshot from May 2010, but they see a broad positive trend towards more progressive migrant integration policies throughout Europe, the UK being the notable exception, which totally plummets. Now, I was just wondering, this is obviously happening, you know, their analysis is being done before the austerity measures were really kind of kicking in and before we knew the shape of and strength of them. So what kind of effect do you think the austerity measures will reverse the trend that they identify in the results? And I'm just wondering in terms of, like, for example, I mean, the one saving grace for the UK was the strength of its anti-discrimination laws and equality policies. But they did say that the UK was maybe not quite as strong as they should be on enforcement mechanisms. So with the budget for the EHRC, for example, being slashed by more than half, I'm kind of wondering, like, what will be the effect of austerity on these broadly positive trends that they identify?
Yeah, good question.
I'm I haven't looked in depth at the most recent MIFEX. I've pretty much been out of the office ever since it was released. But obviously I know Jan and Thomas very well. What is in my paper, scattered through the various case studies, are examples of where governments have made policy changes at the same time as making budget cuts. So in some cases, a government will have extended the period during which a migrant who's lost their job can look for another before their residence permit runs out, and these sorts of ameliorating measures. On the other hand, you see, and here, you know, the Dutch example is a good one, you see trends towards requiring more from migrants in terms of language learning at an earlier stage and to a higher level. So you see a mix of policy changes. I enjoy reading the MIPEX, but one of the things it doesn't show is how much of this is on paper and how much of this is in practice. And I think the problem is it's all very well having it on paper, but if there's no money to back it up or there's no serious policy investment in making sure it works in practice, then, you know, it can look great, but it doesn't help. And I wonder whether what has always been a slight problem in a number of countries, and Belgium's always been cited as doing very well in MIPEX, and Belgian NGOs say this doesn't help us at all because we know what's happening on the ground, but it comes out very well and we lose advocacy ground because we can't argue. I think that gap might widen as time goes on, given the programmatic changes that have happened in some countries across Europe.
Thank you. So another paradox, really. Can I turn to you, Trevor? We heard from Spain that the EHRC's been, and the sort of British rule of law has been used as a basis for their model. At the same time, you know, we know from other polls and from the report that we published recently on with the German Marshall Fund on transatlantic trends, that in many respects the UK fares quite badly. It sounds fairly contradictory, doesn't it?
Badly in respect of
public attitudes to migration.
Okay.
And integration.
It is quite difficult, but of course it all depends on what question you ask. Can I say one matter of fact? I know it's sort of got around that our budget is being slashed massively, and I don't mind that if it induces a vast amount of panic and people throw money at the Commission, but in fact the Commission and its sponsor unit won't suffer any more reduction than anybody else in public service, to be honest. We probably will take a hit, quite a big hit, about 40%, but that's by 2015. By that time, I'll be long gone. There says a dedicated public servant. There are rather bigger issues which are really to do with what we do and what government does. And it relates to your point in a way, Sarah, that I think that the position that we're in now, and I don't want to overstate this, I'm always, because I have a sort of sunny optimism about life, I'm always accused of being overly optimistic. But I think it is true that there's been a broad shift in public sentiment on the issue of race specifically. To put it crudely, not that many people hate me because of the colour I am in this country, which is not true for my parents. That does not mean that we are not uneasy about migration. And I think in some ways it is even sharper now than it used to be, because what inward migration represents is not alien force, but change of our own way of life. And it's, you know, there's an interesting piece of work, it's done by Ipsos Mori, which suggests that the real thing that propels far-right success is not the actual level of change. You know, some of the areas where, if you like, there is the greatest diversity or the greatest penetration by ethnic minorities are actually the ones in which there's least angst What makes a difference is the speed at which an area changes. They did a little exercise for me about 2 years ago in which they looked at the speed at which the number of ethnic groups in certain areas had changed. The area which had changed fastest in the country was Barking and Dagenham, which then proceeded, as per prediction, to elect, I think at that time, 13 BNP councillors. So I think that the experience here is that we need to make sure that of two things. One is we don't get too fixated with what is an historic understanding of why it is that people are anxious about immigration. And secondly, that we don't, as I think, you know, some I would certainly say, and I think other people, there'll be other people who say this, I'd be interested to know what Sundar makes of this, that there is a sense in which the political elite, especially the liberal elite in this country, has spent a long time telling people that they're a bit stupid and racist to be worried about immigration, and actually that in itself has been a bit of helped to create part of the problem.
Sundar, do you want to accept that
pattern? Yeah, fine. I think it's important to make some distinctions, and in some ways I think we're conflating things that we were keeping distinct. So I mean, by 2010 we have to be making quite a lot of distinctions between integration policies of different types towards settled communities and new arrivals and immigration policies. And I think part of the historical problem was that these things were always seen as conflated and identical, and yet we might be slipping back towards thinking your immigration and your integration policies are identical. I think there is a challenge to liberal elites in terms of what's been going on. Why is this quite a darkening mood? I think it's because you've got a double whammy of two different forms of pessimism. I think there's a kind of cultural pessimism that has set us back quite a long way that arises out of September 2001. 2005 in this country, and so a specific set of antagonisms around Muslim communities specifically that actually have taken sort of race and integration debates back to a more polarised era that they were getting out of. And now you've got an economic pessimism that's come along as well, and that, you know, obviously it's rational for young people not to feel enormously kind of upbeat about a borderless world if they can't get a job. And the recent survey for Searchlight, I think, was useful in segmenting groups. You know, there's a third of people who are broadly comfortable with the type of change we've seen. There's a quarter to a third that's quite hostile. And there are two groups in the middle. And one group is economically insecure and anxious contains most of the settled ethnic minority populations. Another group is culturally anxious. And I think we have to have responses to both of those. You know, both of those points separately. They're different points, and they require different responses. I think just finally, another distinction I think we need to make is I think it's quite worrying that on broad questions of has immigration overall, has it been a disaster or has it been good for us, etc., do we have good race relations, these things are now moving badly against where we would want them to be. These ought to be winnable debates, partly because we can't do anything about the fact that we will have multi-ethnic society, so we'd certainly better have legitimacy for them. What I was struck by in the Searchlight research was that on do we have good race relations in this country, has immigration been good or bad across the whole period? You know, that's now 40-60. CRE was doing studies around 2006. These are quite positive, actually. So something that hadn't been lost immediately after 2005, when there was a mobilisation to make sure that people stayed on that, has actually been lost in the longer period, whether that's a longer experience of the cultural issue or whether that's a kind of the economic factor, I don't think we know. But separating that question of, you know, can we have confidence in the society we inevitably are from the question of policy towards immigration now seems to me quite important. And then finally on integration, I just think we need some... This integration fatigue point seems to me quite an important challenge. But it's predicated, I think, in public discussion on the idea we've tried everything and it's totally impossible. And we need some outcomes, not just the inputs of funding on integration, but how well have we done on integration? I know Trevor's commission has done some of this. The invisible you know, we don't see the integration that works. The broad story of integration is a pretty positive one. I mean, it's not comparing like with like, but you compare these employment numbers, and the unemployment rates of foreign nationals in the UK are pretty similar to the employment rates of UK residents. And so there are specific problems, but if we don't have an argument about how integration has worked, then of course you'll have integration fatigue. And I just think we need to put some quite strong evidence-based points in about where the successes have been and where the gaps are. And I think at the moment that's missing quite a lot.
Thank you. I think that's very true, and that's a reminder about good news stories, isn't it, and how powerful they can be, evidence-based but also human stories. But, Diana.
Thank you. I'm Diana Leet. I'm actually a member of the board of the Diana Princess of Wales Memorial Fund, and I'm not from the Paul Hamlin Foundation, though I have great admiration for them and I'm open to offers. I wanted to carry on. Just thank you to everybody who's spoken, because it was absolutely fascinating. But I have to say, I found it also, as I'm sure we were meant to, extremely disturbing and frightening in many ways. But I feel a bit that we're sort of assuming that the future will just be more of the same. And I wonder what I would like to ask each member of the panel, what is it that we could actually do, or what might happen to make things less pessimistic? And I know that there are some foundations in the UK who are actually discussing possible courses of action, or a course of action that might contribute to that. And yes, I would be very interested to hear from the panel. If you could have one wish, a realistic one, what would it be that might actually make the future less bleak than it seems to be?
Thank you for the question. I'm going to focus on the problem on Spain, on your question on the problem on Spain, and I love what Dimitri just said, because I firmly believe in that. I mean, a lot of people are blaming immigrants for this crisis. A lot of people are blaming, or especially those three sectors Dimitri mentioned, the youngsters, minorities, and immigrants are suffering from this crisis. I have been blamed. But for example, in Spain, if you ask me what is the best solution to get out of this crisis, well, I would say to lower the prices of the buildings, to lower the prices of the construction. But it is amazing that an apartment in Madrid or Barcelona, it's more expensive than an apartment in Berlin, while the salaries in Madrid and Barcelona are much lower than in Berlin. Why is the Germany economy going up? I mean, in Spain, and I guess in other countries, the construction bubble has gone too far. That's why immigrants came. It's not only the construction bubble. I think the Spain's economy have other parts very strong and has grew in the last 10, 15 years very firmly. But our main problem is that one. And the prices are not going down.
Do we have an economist in the room that could give us a view about growth?
Okay. Can I make a comment anyway?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
It's Barrett Metta, Trust for London. Apropos Diana's question, I just wondered where the panelists actually stood on the whole issue around sort of inequality within and between nations. Because inequality within and between nations actually fuels a lot of movement. It fuels wars, it fuels famine, because you look at the food prices, which are different here than in Europe. I mean, it's interesting about the RPI rated increases here and over RPI rated, whereas they're well below on basic foodstuffs in Europe. So it fuels greed. And I just wonder whether there are sort of other ways in which the issues around migration and the consequences of migration can actually be addressed? Because I found the contributions, whilst very interesting, I found them sort of possibly wrist-slashing in the sense of how depressed I felt about the outcome. So I just wonder about sort of, you know, moving forwards. I'm in Diana's camp here. We would like something sort of positive about what can be done. I think there are small things that we could do. Building resilience in communities, the sort of work that Barrow Cadbury Trust has done, I think it's important. It's about enabling not just survival but adaption, adapting to the changes that are taking place. I think there is possibility of influencing on a global platform on not just migration but actually on economics as well. I think there are certain things that are possible, maybe too large for a small trust like us working in London, but I think together and with some of the people on the platform, I'm sure there's possibilities of going somewhere.
Gosh, Barrett, I think your record on this at Trust for London is an extremely good one. You're being very modest. But, Dimitri, the two questions together, a good news story, an optimistic thought linked to global equalities and inequalities.
I certainly don't want anyone to go home and slash theirs.
No. You want them to work harder.
Let's establish that. Working harder is the instruction from here. But I don't know what the future may look like. Certainly the past has not been a single past. There are lots of different pasts. It occurs to me that we have forgotten some lessons that we have learned from the past that can actually move us forward. For instance, immigrants are particularly resilient in economic times, bad and good. So if you were to think in terms of small steps that can make over time a big difference, find out, you know, what are the factors for immigrant resilience in the past in the UK and try to do that. So that's very important. You have good examples for communities in which, you know, people have learned how to live together and move the community forward. Well, you know, try to replicate those, you know, advertise them, you know, sort of put them into the public debate. There's no reason, you know, this is a conversation among ourselves, you know, we need to sort of, you know, tell the picture, as it were, the way it is. By definition, you know, these events focus on what is problematic. Otherwise, you know, they become sort of like, an advertising machine. We want that. The issue of inequality within and between, you know, this is, you know, if you're thinking in terms of a 30 to 50 year agenda, I think everyone here will agree, you know, that this is what we need to be able to accomplish. Because sort of this is what I call the Alexandrian solution. Alexander the Great, the Gordian knot, everybody's trying to untie the knot. He says, oh, hell, you know, this is children's game. He takes his sword out and cuts through the knot. Well, that's going to take 30 to 50 years. And there are efforts that try to think, you know, about more cooperative kind of relationships between states that inevitably will need to much less migration because people have no other option. Remember, people don't choose to migrate because it's fun. Now, they know the circumstances that they're going to encounter. You know, we don't give immigrants enough credit. You know, the networks and, you know, the ability to communicate is at a much finer, granular level than, you know, anything that we may discuss among ourselves. So this is not fun for the immigrants. It's a survival strategy for a lot of immigrants. Now, there is a different kind of immigrant who migrates in order to take advantage of opportunity differentials. But that's not what we're talking about here, right? The ones that want to take advantage of opportunity differentials have assets. I don't mean necessarily money. But, you know, they have skills, they have experience, they have knowledge, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, since I'm not going to be around, just to borrow a phrase from one of my colleagues here, you know, 30 years from now, I'll leave it to all of you young people, you know, to try to reduce inequality. I don't know at which point governments will get the point that extreme inequality is not good for anyone, not even for the people who make all of the money, because then they become the target of everybody else. We all thought that maybe that might be one of the lessons that we take out of what happened the last 2 years. You know, if you look at the headlines in FT yesterday about how much money, you know, the big guys took, you know, in the banking sector in terms of bonuses and all that, you know. And the same thing is happening on Wall Street, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know that we'll get to that point. In terms of inequality between states, we have to think of a different model than the one that we have operated under in the past 30 or 50 years. This is not about aid. Okay? This is about making different kinds of investments over there. But bureaucracies are the ones who give money and, in a sense, encourage investments. Bureaucracies simply do the same thing that they've always done and hope for a different outcome. And actually, smarter people than me have, you know, christened, you know, this as delusion. So let's try to restructure, you know, our foreign aid and overseas aid. These are not easy things. I don't think that more immigration is the answer. I think if you wanted to be harsh as to what happened with regard to migration over the past 10 years, and I can be harsh, the rate of growth, exactly what, you know, Trevor talked about, but he was talking about the community level. The rate of growth, the speed of growth, speed of change, was by definition unsustainable. You can't grow, take Spain, take my country of birth, take the UK, take Ireland, you know. The rate of growth of from a couple of percentage points to, let me tell you what, 12 or 14%, depending on whether you look at the census data or not, brings Spain and Ireland and UK, if you had continued on this path, brings the immigrant density of this country to the level, in other words, immigrants per capita, at the level at which the United States is. Let me just let you absorb this. We've been in the immigration business for 600 years. It all depends how you count, 200, 250, I don't care. Okay? These countries switched from emigration countries to massive immigration countries in a decade. There is no historical precedent for anything like that. You cannot build the institution. You cannot remake your institutions fast enough. You can hardly build a legal framework to basically be able to adapt to that. These are realities on the ground that governments have to face. And maybe there is a lesson in this. You have to really invest in trying to make things, you know, work together over the next, you know, with regard to the question about, you know, the future. We have to invest on those kinds of things while at the same time keeping your place, your country open to more immigration, but in a measured way, focused much more in the labor market. So yes, you can construct a series of small steps and you can actually get out of where you are now 5 years, if not stronger, but not weaker. But it takes effort and it takes politicians to invest their political capital, which means chance that they might not get reelected in the process. And that's why we need politicians who understand that there is a more important, broader public good.
Thanks. I hope you're feeling more cheerful, Barrett. Would you like to come in with, in particular, something upbeat, but also to comment on the equality agenda and political will in that regard, and how you see that.
Oh, okay. Okay, five sentences, which are all cheerful. First sentence, Spain. The numbers of the speed at which Spain has changed. Unbelievable. And they're happy. They're cheerful. No riots. That, to me, big, big plus. I don't know how you did it, but actually, you did it. That's cheerful number one. Cheerful number two, the reason I banged on endlessly about the point about race is that actually, in the old days, you couldn't do anything about the immigrants' race. We can't, I mean, if the source of hostility was race, what are you going to do about that? Actually, if the issue now is about how you manage infrastructure and funds and all the rest, that to me is susceptible to politics. We can actually do something about that. And I think that's a cause for rejoicing. Third thing, I think there's a big thing that we ought to be doing. I spent the part of the morning with a dozen ministers about SMEs. That's where job growth is going to come. And by the way, disproportionately, small and medium size enterprise are built by minorities and migrants and people like that fact, and that, you know, the corner shop changed people's ideas. I think that's a third thing. Fourth thing, and that's not necessarily going to be popular in this room, big society, great opportunity. I mean, I think all the people who are sort of not already built into the Conservative Party have a rather difficult way, problem with this, because everybody faces two ways. We all like the idea of empowerment, and we all like the idea of, you know, cooperatives and all the rest of it, as long as these things belong not to a different political tradition. Actually, I think we need to get rid of all of that, and we need to embrace it. One absolutely glaring contradiction that we have about this issue, about the big society, is that everybody is delighted by the idea that, and I'm touching lightly on the issue of multiculturalism, that, you know, people are allowed to express themselves and all the rest of it, unless they happen to be Muslims who want to set up schools. And then we all get very, very anxious about this. I think we just got to get our heads out of this and accept that a diverse society will mean also diverse institutions. We can then talk about the rules that govern those diverse institutions. But there is a very odd contradiction in some of the political traditions here about that, really. And the last point on equality. One of the reasons that I can sort of sit here smiling is that I think that last year something quite remarkable happened. We had... It is... one of the three or four biggest pieces of legislation ever passed by the Parliament, the Equality Act 2010, dragged in gazillions of things, you know, spent a lot of time buried under all this paper and so on. What is the most striking thing about it? It eventually was passed with the support of all parties. The coalition government has come in. It has enacted virtually all of it, including some things that the Conservatives said that they wouldn't. Positive action, for example. Why? Not because they've suddenly... Well, they have changed, and that's the important thing. There's a whole new social norm. Whereas 5 years ago, there wasn't a common political consensus that equality and anti-discrimination needed a legal basis. Now, it is pretty much unchallengeable, actually, right across the political spectrum. Nobody would say that they don't want that. There are arguments which we're going to have now about whether it's a burden on business and all that stuff, but nobody is now going to say, except a few slightly bonkers people on the right of the Conservative Party, let's get rid of the Equality Act. And that, I think, that's never, in my experience, been the case. There's never been that level of consensus. And by the way, that's a small political point. I think that's a tribute to the last Labour government, that they achieved that.
And at the very 11th hour. I can see several people would like to respond to that, and the gentleman at the back was first. Can you tell us who you are? Sorry.
Thank you. Mazen Zeki, National Secular Society. I also don't want anybody slashing their wrists. But if they do, then they could do it to a Leonard Cohen song, which I believe is very highly recommended. Well, thank you for all your contributions. Trevor Phillips never fails to... he's consistent. I never agree with anything he says. So there's nothing remarkable in that, except for his comment about shifts in certain factories. And that's very, very true, and that's how the divisions started in the mill towns, when shifts were very much based on ethnicity and religion. And then 20 years later, when nobody talked about it, particularly the ruling parties in those towns, then we had the riots in Oldham, Bradford, and Burnley. Now, I think that, I don't want to depress people, but I don't really believe that we're going in the right direction here, because I can't talk about other countries, but in Britain, certainly there's more and more segregation, and that segregation is based on the educational system. And, it's all very well talking about integration, but actually there are different forms of integration. There's integration in the labor market, there's social integration. Above all, there's educational segregation. And that's driven increasingly by faith schools, which Labour promoted and which this government will also be promoting through free schools, which will increasingly be taken up by faith groups. And, of course, at the same time, there's this kind of continual and deliberate conflation between faith and ethnicity, which I think is deeply damaging. The two things are quite separate. They should not be confused. Increasingly, those forms of segregation will become more embedded and more difficult to reverse, regardless of other forms of intervention. Now, I don't know what can be done about that, but I would say that the obsession with identity, which has surfaced in this whole debate over many years, has actually produced less and less integration and more segregation. It's a kind of vicious circle. Which is often disguised by the progressive language of multiculturalism, but what is actually done in practice is to create more segregation, something which I think should disturb all of us, because once it's also based on a mass. Once it reaches a certain proportion, it becomes very, very difficult to deal with, and increasingly in Britain, that is exactly what is happening. Now, obviously, the National Secular Society has a very specific position. We would like to do away with faith schools in the long term. In the short term, we want to ensure that they don't discriminate, for example. Now, I know that there are some faith schools which might actually be functioning quite well, but on the whole, the long-term effect is to create more division at a local level and at a national level. Now, I haven't heard anything, for example, from the EHRC about this. I haven't heard anything from any political party about this. It's apparently a subject which just can be ignored. But in practice, it's creating more division. Now, there's another issue here within the labour market. Now, I would argue that one of the most important things in the labour market is the rigid enforcement of the minimum wage. Now, it's often seen as a great achievement of the last government. The average employer would have to wait 334 years before an inspector turned up to look at the minimum wage. Now, this is also a subject which the TUC itself has not actually talked about much. There are three cases in the European Court of Justice, not the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Justice, the Ruffert, Viking, and Luxembourg cases, which if they court judgment is enacted in its fullest sense, will mean that the trade unions will be liable for any losses incurred during a strike, which will actually make strikes impossible to win and will also make it impossible to enforce and defend the minimum wage, because it specifically allows for the subversion of the Posted Workers Directive, which means that what's called social dumping. Labour forces can be imported at below the minimum wage, and that will be quite legal. Now, that, I would argue, would be a source of serious social tensions. But, of course, even the TUC has not actually made a comment about that. So those are some of the issues which I would submit to you. And on the question of translation, by the way, which I think Trevor mentioned, I mean, the move against translation is not because of cuts now. It's because of the Commission on Integration and Cohesion under Dara Singh. They came out against translation because translations also, while having a short-term positive effect, can have long-term negative effect, and so on and so forth. So I think that there are issues here which sometimes the progressive agenda would rather ignore, and it does so at its peril.
Thank you very much for that quick canter through a lot of other issues of social policy, and that whole issue about faith schools is really a hot potato, and we can't cover all of the things that you're raising there, particularly about the minimum wage in today's meeting. But I don't want Liz to lose the opportunity to give her optimistic ideas, as the other people on the panel all have, if you have any, and also possibly to. I didn't catch your name, sir, I'm sorry, but to I know Liz is doing a lot of work on identity. Whether you wanted to pick up on anything from the last speaker's contribution.
I don't think I can really pick up anything on identity except to say that it's going to be a focus for the Transatlantic Council for the rest of this year, so we hope to come back with more as we get to December. On idealism, I was told off yesterday for grandiose visions of idealism, which struck me that cynicism and scepticism are very, very fashionable, and that might be one of the root causes of some of the problems we see today. So perhaps I can end on a more conceptual note that a little bit of idealism is no bad thing, and a little bit of leadership to go with that idealism would be a huge step forward, without any particular policy recommendations to go along with that.
Thank you. I'm going to give a plug while we're on. Several people around the room have mentioned good examples, good stories, and good evidence. One of the pieces of work that we're involved in, my colleague Claire at the back leads on this for us, is called Cities of Migration, and it's an international, intercontinental piece of work demonstrating good practice in integration in various parts of the world, and it's a web-based, very easy to access, hundreds of good examples on that. So, just a little plug for that. Okay, we've still got 10 minutes if we're not going to run out of steam. But there's still several hands over in this corner, gentleman in the middle.
Hello, my name's John Spey. I'm from Music in Detention. I was interested in the question about migration and race, and the suggestion that migration is becoming decoupled from race. I have to say, in the work we do on the ground, I wouldn't say that was the case. I mean, not based on that. It feels to me more as if there is a kind of complicated collection of concepts and ideas which you know might be captured by terms like migration and race and faith and security and alienation and so on, and there's a reconfiguration maybe going on. But I would say I'd be quite concerned really at the idea that that people don't see migration as anything to do with race, and maybe I'm overstating what was being claimed. I mean, for example, the way there are old forms of racism which maybe are not mainstream anymore, but anti-Muslim sentiment, arguably, very mainstream now. So I'd see that as a kind of reconfiguration, and I'm pretty sure that anti-Muslim feeling is not purely about religion. So I think that we need to keep a close eye on how ideas about race play into discussions that are about migration or and play into people's feelings about their own situations. And I'm interested to see whether I've misunderstood or to get a kind of more to get a clearer view on that.
Just one sentence. I'm not saying I think that, you know, it's all hunky-dory, it's all sorted. All I'm saying is I think there isn't the straightforward one-to-one correspondence. And I think if you go and just walk around some northern towns, actually, I know I'm stretching it a bit here, I can imagine a time quite soon when the sort of hostility that we think of in relation to, let's say, Burnley or somewhere like that, has less to do with migration and is a bit more like Belfast
in the sense that these people are a different kind of people. They belong to our town, but they're just so different. Why it is to some extent lost in the past. All I'm saying is it's not just about migration. There isn't a straightforward, we hate migrants because they're black. And there isn't a straightforward, we hate blacks because they're migrants. There are all sorts of other things interpolating, as you're saying here. And one of the reasons the EDL has been successful is that they make a big deal of saying it's not about race, it's about culture. You know. They, you know, it's something they've spotted.
Will they play into that? Yeah,
yeah, of course. Yeah. We're violently agreeing, really.
And the lady in the corner.
Yes, I'm Faiza Shaheen from the New Economics Foundation. Just a couple of comments, straight questions. On the economy, there seems to be an assumption that if you have higher growth, then migrants are more welcome, that they can take jobs, etc. And I think that we've seen, even before the recession, there were problems, and I don't think that's quite true and that straightforward, although obviously decreased employment opportunities do cause a problem. And there's another complication there now around the kind of green agenda, the kind of question whether we can continue to have these growth levels if we are going to have a kind of low-carbon economy. And it's a problem of kind of complicating a complicated matter further. And secondly, on kind of inequality, and something that struck me within sort of an economy like London, where you see an increase of kind of highly skilled, highly paid workers, and then sort of skilled workers that support that growth in retail, etc., who are typically quite relatively low paid. Actually, migration, in a sense, has supported that polarization. And there's almost another paradox here about actually the support for migration in cities for London, which is quite exceptional in its support, is because it does support that kind of way of life. And actually, you know, it's this problem of, do we want migration to be supporting an unequal economy, which in a sense it's doing right now. So there, it comes back to this question about, you know, redesigning our economy, I guess.
I think it might be a little bit unfair to ask overseas guests to comment on the London hourglass economy, although it's a point well made. Dimitri, have you got a view, on the other hand, on whether relentless economic growth is sustainable in the long term?
Yes, but I'm afraid to put it on the table because we may have more risk. Slashing.
Touché.
I think that we have to adjust ourselves to the fact that the kind of economic growth that we saw in the past 10 or 15 years is not going to be available to us in all likelihood because of the reconfiguration, you know, of economic sort of centers of power, as it were. And on the issue of whether sort of economic good news somehow, you know, will make us happier about immigration, if I understood you correctly, I think I agree with you. You know, there is an association between good economic times and being more relaxed about things. But it masks all sorts of things that continue to happen on the ground. And, you know, you can't run away from what Dr. Trevor said, which is, you know, one of the things that has been happening on the ground in the past 10 or 15 years is an awful lot of change, an awful lot of difference of all types. In the UK, it may have to do with, you know, many things, but I suspect that, you know, certainly Muslims, you know, in other places, it's something like that. It's some different issue. There was a study that was just published. I'm not even sure that I was a reviewer of the book, but I think the book has been out. It basically looks at national labor force surveys and European level labor force surveys. And not surprisingly, the people that come, not at the bottom, that maybe is expected, but at the bottom with a large gap, are people of color, people from Africa, both North Africa and Sub-Saharan. I think you can feel happy about all sorts of things, but they cannot ignore the realities on the ground. And we've discussed the realities of the ground here, whether it's inequality, whether it's failures of government, etc., etc. And rebuilding all the things that we need to rebuild is going to take a long time. We have to start somewhere, I get the point. But it's going to take a long time. And in the process, we must not fall victims either to the pessimists or to the optimists. You know, enthusiasm does not change the facts on the ground. Pessimism doesn't help if it simply leads us to go to a corner and hide. So we really have to really work harder as, you know, people like us, but also as policymakers, etc., etc., because we need to adjust to a constantly shifting environment. And things that we knew or we thought we knew about yesterday are not going to be the same things tomorrow, because everything is changing at the same time. We have to understand outsourcing differently. We have to address the issue of whether we bring all of these young immigrants and they take the top jobs and other people feel, you know, left out. We keep, you know, theorizing or accepting the theorizing of macroeconomists that say, you know, that there are no adverse, you know, wage effects or labor market effects. You know, if the way that the man in the street or the woman in the street feels the effects of immigration, of outsourcing, of openness to trade, etc., etc., differently than what the macroeconomists say that they are, I go every day, 100% of the time, with a person on the street. You don't have to be a smart politician to understand that something is happening down there. And we have the unfortunate, difficult task, and foundations in particular, to try to do something about that. And that's where the idea of, you know, working harder, of, you know, working with people on the ground, trying to make a difference in the educational system and the workforce development system, you know, and the I don't know, we call it welfare in the United States, I don't know what you call it here, you know, sort of social support system.
Benefits
and things like that. All of those things have to work in concert. And I challenge you, this way I can go take you back to pessimism. What government was good at allowing all of those things to work in concert? In the United States, none. Maybe here, there was a government for a period of time. I will leave you to make that judgment. It takes the wisdom of Solomon, if Solomon was wise, but let's assume he was, and the patience of Job, if Job was patient, in order to actually move forward an agenda, a forward-looking agenda in the next several years.
Thank you very much. I want to offer the last word, not that I'm suggesting that he has the wisdom of Solomon or the patience of Job, but he does. But Vaughan, I wonder if you have any closing comment about how this will help you who tirelessly work at the ground?
You're sending me back to work. I think the thoughts have been going through my mind. I was going to ask a question, but I wasn't sure how to frame it. Really, it's about the balance between civil society and government, and it sort of touched upon a little bit when the big society was mentioned. But it seems to me the big society is the most irrelevant thing imaginable, because it's something that's thought out there, whereas actually civil society has been bubbling along and doing that all along, and particularly in relationship to migration, the entrepreneurism and so on within communities and so on. That will go on and that will continue. And the harder the times, the more likely we are to be responding in innovative ways. And that's irrelevant to whether or not a government can put a label on it and call it their policy. But I do wonder what the role and where the role of partnership comes in that resilience, because that's what it is. Where does the partnership come in, and where can we expect within civil society and at grassroots levels, where can we expect to build partnerships with government and with the economists and with commerce and who else, and where are the real levers for building those partnerships now? At the moment, I suspect they're more likely to be at local level, and that's been mentioned, I think, somewhere along the line as to where integration strategies and policies really bite and work is in the local communities into which people move. But actually, you'd need to have that partnership right from civil society, right through foundations, right through to local government, to regional government, to central government, and to European and global institutions to get it right. But you'd need more than the patience of Job and the wisdom of Solomon to do all that.
Thank you, Vaughan. I think that's a great note on which to finish. Thank you for the work that you do on the ground, other people in the room that do as well. Can we thank our panel in the time on the floor?
For more information on MPI's Transatlantic Council on Migration, please visit migrationpolicy.org/transatlantic.